How safe are national parks, especially for women hikers?
Statistically speaking, we are safe in national parks, but it is also true that crimes, especially violent crimes in our national parks, have been underrepresented, underreported, underinvestigated. And one of the things that I really started to uncover in my own research is just how little of a system we have for the reporting and investigating of violent crimes in our national parks.
That's Catherine Miles. We talk with her about her new book, Trailed: One Woman's Quest to Solve the Shenandoah Murders. It's about two remarkable women who were murdered in the park in 1996 and the long road to find their killer. Then, as 2022 is slated to experience a severe hurricane season, we revisit our 2015 conversation with Miles about her book, Superstorm. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In May 1996, two skilled backcountry leaders, Lolly Winans and Julie Williams, entered Virginia's Shenandoah National Park for a week-long backcountry camping trip. After the pair did not return home as planned, park rangers found their tent slashed open, their dog missing, and both women dead in their sleeping bags. When journalist and author Catherine Miles began looking into the case, she found conflicting evidence, mismatched timelines, and details that did not add up. An innocent man, Miles is convinced, has been under suspicion for decades, while the true culprit is a known serial killer. But Trailed is more than a gripping true crime story. It's a plea to make wilderness a safer space for women and to change the cultural narratives that put them at risk. Catherine Miles, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's nice to be back on the show.
It's been a while, but it's really such a pleasure. It was such a pleasure to read this book, although it was also a scary pleasure sometimes.
Yeah, it's sort of a strange phenomenon to be promoting a book that can sometimes feel a little hard to recommend just because some of the subject matter is so grim.
But it's reality. And you really tell it well, Trailed, One Woman's Quest to Solve the Shenandoah Murders. So the book is about the murders of two young women who were a couple in Shenandoah National Park in May of 1996, Lolly Winans and Julie Williams. So tell us a little bit about these women.
Yeah, you know, and they were just such an exceptional set of people. So I'm really glad to have you ask that question. Julie Williams was born and raised in a small town in Minnesota, a really close-knit Catholic family. And by the time she was in high school, her friends were sort of lovingly, jokingly calling her a one-woman Peace Corps. She was fluent in Spanish, and she served as an interpreter and an advocate for domestic abuse survivors. She was a geologist by training and had done work not only doing archaeological digs in Europe and doing water quality work in some Minnesota Native American lands, but she also did missionary work in Central and South America. And she had arrived at a really wonderful outdoor organization called Woods Women in the spring of 1995, where she took an advanced canoeing skills course and fell so in love with the program that she decided to go back and take a leadership course so that she could begin leading trips through the organization. And it was there in that leadership course that she met Lolly Winans, and who a lot of ways was kind of the yin to Julie's yang. Lolly was raised in a very, very affluent family in Michigan, had a troubled relationship with her family because of some abuse that she had endured at the hands of her stepfather. And she had kind of cast around a little bit trying to make sense of all of that. and had eventually found her way to Unity College, a small college here in Maine where I live. And she had dedicated herself to creating an outdoor wilderness program, a therapeutic wilderness program for other domestic abuse and sexual assault survivors. She was wonderfully outgoing by all accounts, had a great sense of humor, was always the life of the party, loved the Grateful Dead and jam bands and music festivals, and, you know, kind of was the extrovert in some ways to Julie's introvertedness. And by all accounts, when they met in May of 1995, it was really just love at first sight for both of them.
And you mentioned Unity College. You still teach there, is that right?
No, I don't. The college underwent some really pretty radical changes in recent years. And I actually left the college in about 2014, 2015. I still teach in some low residency graduate school programs, but not at Unity per se.
But there was that connection. You became really obsessed with a story, and there was more to the connection you felt than just having taught at the same college where Lolly had attended. So tell us about what brought you into this story so completely.
I first learned of the story in 1998 when I was backpacking on the Appalachian Trail, and had really, I think, had an experience that in some ways was similar to Lolly and Julie. And that was, you know, all three of us were sexual assault survivors who had really found a sense of strength and purpose as backpackers and long distance hikers out in the wilderness. And, you know, for me, that was really my sort of sacred space in a lot of ways. And I was actually on a backpacking trip in Pennsylvania in the fall of 1998 when I learned about the murder of Lolly and Julie, as well as the murder of several other couples. And that really radically changed my relationship with the wilderness. And so, you know, I think from that moment onward, I thought a lot about that crime and crime similar. One of the survivors of one of these attacks, a woman named Claudia Brenner, had written a book called Eight Bullets, which was about her attack, which had killed her partner and which had left her nearly mortally wounded. And that book had a really, really big impact on me as a reader and a thinker. And so then flash forward a few years, and I was a professor at Unity in the spring of 2002, when the Justice Department and John Ashcroft, who was the Attorney General at the time, announced that not only would he be seeking the death penalty after having indicted an individual for the murder of Lolly and Julie, but he would also be treating this case as the first federal hate crime in U.S. history. So that was a very defining moment for our college campus. And I saw firsthand both the residual, I think, grief that people had experienced with the initial crime, and as well as this new kind of complicated wrinkle with the hate crime legislation being enacted using this case.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic that it was John Ashcroft, and we'll return to him a little bit later in the questions, but I want to pursue this idea of hate crime, because it turns out that our national parks aren't particularly safe places for women.
Yeah, you know, and, you know, I always kind of want to make a little bit of a caveat, which is that, you know, statistically speaking, we are safe in national parks. But it is also true that crimes, especially violent crimes in our national parks, have been underrepresented, underreported, underinvestigated. And one of the things that I really started to uncover in my own research is just how little of a system we have for the reporting and investigating of violent crimes in our national parks. It's a big problem that as a country we really need to confront, especially as attendance in these parks continues to rise, especially after COVID.
Yeah, and I said before, not a safe place for women, but especially queer women. I mean, this is Lolly and Julie were not the only lesbian couple who have been murdered, in wilderness. I'm not sure the other case I'm thinking of was actually in a national park, but talk about the misogyny that is, that attends women who go backpacking.
I think there's a certain set, and luckily I think it's a very small set, but I think there's a certain set of white men who feel that the wilderness is their domain. And not only do they feel that the world wilderness is their domain, but they feel like rules don't apply there. And I think there's a variety of reasons why that happens. I think some actually kind of have a basis in feelings that I think are almost justifiable. And if you take a look at the founding of some parks, like for instance Shenandoah National Park, there were thousands of Appalachian homesteaders who were forcefully evicted off of their family lands in order to found that park. And for some of those individuals, for instance, I think they rightfully feel like their land was taken from them unjustly. That I think is justifiable. Some of them choose then to kind of take law into their own hands. And for instance, at Shenandoah, we see really rampant poaching, both of animals like black bears and then also endangered plant species like ginseng. And those poachers would tell you, well, this was our land to begin with, so we have every right to break these laws and do this. I think there's another set of men who really feel like, the wilderness can be this kind of bizarre, twisted playground. And, there have been multiple people who have been brought to justice for committing really terrible acts of violence, especially against women in the wilderness. And they use really strange metaphors like, well, that's my hunting ground and things like that. And so I think unpacking what's really happening there, unpacking this brand of toxic masculinity that manifests in really disturbing ways in the wilderness is something that we really need to do as a culture.
Yeah, it really made me think because I used to do a lot of backpacking and I used to do a lot of it alone. Luckily, I never had an encounter that, was dangerous of any kind. But after reading this book, I kind of slapped myself on the forehead and said, "What was I thinking?"
Well, you were thinking that the wilderness is a beautiful place, right? And I mean, there's so many wonderful things that the wilderness has to offer all of us. I think, and I certainly don't want this book to keep people out of the wilderness, but I do want to really compel a national conversation about who gets to be in the wilderness, who gets to feel safe in the wilderness, and why.
And it's a conversation that the organization that Lolly and Julie met at, Woods Women, formed as a response. And you also talk about a movement that happened after their death called Take Back the Trails. So before we move on to explore the crime more, tell us a little bit about, what women are doing or have done to make the wilderness safer for us.
Yeah, the history is really interesting to me, and I wanted to try to include as much of it as I could in the book. When you think about the sort of American wilderness ethic, and you think more immediately about the American outdoor recreation industry, it really kind of found its footing in the years right after World War II, when you had all of these highly trained wilderness individuals, many of whom had served in the 10th Mountain Division, who came back highly skilled from the war and with equipment that people had never had, like fabrics that would not hold water like cotton, nylon ropes that made rock climbing easier and more manageable. And so in those years after they came back from the war, they founded several leading outdoor organizations, including Outward Bound and the National Outdoor Leadership School. And that was really, I think, for a lot of Americans, especially of a certain generation, their first real exposure to outdoor recreation. But at the time, these organizations were really kind of based on this masculine, hierarchical, almost military model, where individuals were expected to sort of confront an increasing risk, which might begin with a trust fall back at the base camp and then would eventually, conclude with rappelling off of a mountain. But as I say in the book, that model really only works for a certain set of people. And if you're somebody who's already wary about the wilderness, or you're somebody who already has experienced some trauma, this idea of being forced to constantly confront increasing risk is not a viable model for you. And so the organizers of Woods Women in the late 1970s, early 1980s, really wanted to create a corrective to that, that was a more sort of holistic, all-inclusive, consensus-based model for bringing people out into the wilderness. And they really revolutionized the outdoor leadership and the outdoor recreation fields as we know it, and really did a ton of fantastic work to increase access to the wilderness, especially for instance, inner city women, children, folks who hadn't really had an articulated relationship with the wilderness before.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Catherine Miles about her latest book, Trailed: One Woman's Quest to Solve the Shenandoah Murders. Now, this was not the only murder of young women near Shenandoah Park. There were some signs that it may have been done by a serial killer, signs early on that don't seem to have been picked up by the authorities. Tell us how they were revealed.
And one of the great things about Algonquin's release of the hardcover of the book is we worked with a very talented cartographer named Margot Carpenter to do a series of maps for the book. And I think these maps, one of which includes these other killings that you mentioned, does a really good job of illuminating just how small of a radius these murders occurred. There were 8 murders, which include Lolly and Shuli, that took place over 16 months in this very rural, sparsely populated part of Virginia. The first of which occurred in March of 1996, a young woman named Alicia Showalter Reynolds. And her body was found really just days, barely even weeks before Lolly and Shuli were murdered. So much of this area was already kind of on red alert. And so when Lolly and Shuli were then, you know, very brutally murdered in late May of 1996, there were no small number of individuals, including some former FBI psychological profilers who had said, you know, this really seems like the work of a serial killer here.
But the National Parks investigation into the crime was, let's say, lax and appallingly so, actually.
Yeah, I think I would actually push back on that just a little bit and say that the investigation, I think once the investigation got underway, I think the investigation was in some ways as good as it could have been. But I think what you're maybe referring to was the initial response. And that was the Parks administration's decision to not release information about this crime until the media discovered it. So for about 3 days, the park sat on this information that a very brutal double murder had occurred not far at all from one of the most populous and most popular lodges in the park. And I really find that decision reprehensible.
Right. But also they tried to say, and they insisted that it was a murder-suicide. It took the park administration quite some time to acknowledge that, you know, with both women's hands bound behind their back and their throats cut, is that right? That this could be a murder-suicide. I mean, how do you cut your own throat and then bind your own hands?
Right. And it was really only because the very sort of dogged and intrepid reporting of some journalists, including a now defunct but really wonderful publication called The Washington Blade, which was an LGBTQ publication at the time. It was those reporters who kept showing up at every single press conference and really pushing these park administrators to explain themselves. And it was really only then that I think the public started to understand what was really going on here.
So now, fast forwarding to 2002, we come back to Attorney General John Ashcroft. He announced that the murder had been solved. A man named Darryl David Rice was arrested, but he ended up going to jail not for the murders of Lolly and Shuli, but rather for another crime. So what happened?
That's right. So we believe that Lolly and Shuli were murdered on May 28th. 1996. In July of 1997, Darryl Rice, who was a young computer programmer who lived in Baltimore, was just experiencing a complete unraveling of his life. He had battled with bipolar schizophrenia for his entire life. He, had really struggled to stay on medications and keep his job and relationships and things like that. And by the spring of 97, all of that had really just started to unravel. He'd been fired from his job, and was really just floundering. His father had a house just outside of the park, and one of Daryl's favorite pastimes was cycling in the park. And one day in July of 1997, he'd been up for several days. He wasn't taking his medication. He'd been smoking a lot of marijuana, and he was sort of aimlessly driving through the park and saw a female cyclist. And really, really harassed, and I'll even say threatened her. He, drove by multiple times. He shouted obscenities and expletives at her. He threw a soda bottle at her. At one point, he ran her off the road. And again, these were all inexcusable actions on his part. They were not, however, murder. But as immediately after the Rangers apprehended him, shortly after he had assaulted this cyclist, they immediately decided that he was also the perpetrator in the murder of Lolly and Julie. And at that point, both the National Park Service investigators and the FBI was just single focused, just, relentless in their pursuit of Rice to the exclusion of all other suspects.
But 2 years later, they did drop the case against him without prejudice. Explain to our listeners what that means.
So, without prejudice is a legal term which is usually reserved for cases where there's been some kind of procedural error along the way. And so the prosecution goes to the judge and says, we still really believe that this individual is guilty. But because of this procedural error, we're not able to proceed to trial in a way that we, feel would result in a conviction. And so we're basically suspending the case against this individual, but we reserve the right to bring it back again. And so it's really kind of a double jeopardy situation. And when John Ashcroft announced the indictment against Darryl Rice in spring of 2002, he also announced that he would be seeking the death penalty using brand new hate crime enhanced legislation. And so in that moment, this also became the first federal hate crime in our country. But so what we have now is that Darryl Rice ultimately lives in this state of double jeopardy, where at any moment, federal prosecutors can bring back, a death penalty case against him. And that has done a tremendous amount of damage to his ability to live a full and meaningful life.
And he was sentenced to 11 years for threatening a woman. That seems rather a draconian sentence.
It was indeed, and that was for this cyclist attack. Not only that, but despite the fact that there was no sexual component to that, they also required him to register as a sex offender, which has also had some pretty significant impacts on his life as well.
You had a lot of trouble getting your FOIAs, your request for information, answered or even allowed from the FBI. And in fact, you say that the more you dug into the case, the more incredulous you became about their handling of it. Talk about that and why you feel it's linked to larger systemic problems in our legal system.
And I ironically, what this book began as a magazine article for Outside Magazine, and at the time, the FBI was beyond generous with their access. So I was able to spend a day at the forensic lab at Quantico to see how DNA testing happens. The FBI representatives, including the lead investigator on this particular case and their evidence response team, went with me to the murder scene. And I think that's when the FBI believed that I would basically be doing sort of a PR story for them about what a great job they've been doing. And as soon as I got my hands on court documents and started to see not only how thin the case was against Rice, but also some real missteps, and I would even go so far as to say malfeasance on the part of the investigators. At that point, the relationship with the FBI changed fairly dramatically. They're sort of notoriously a black box when it comes to information. You know, there are entire sort of organizations of journalist watchdog reporters who are constantly kind of evaluating these rejections of these FOIA requests that the FBI sends, most of which don't have merit. But one of the things that's really disturbing to me is just how little oversight there is for the FBI right now. And so they've basically, you know, it was an organization that's always had a mushy mission statement, always had some kind of mission creep, and that's never really had to account for itself in a meaningful way. And I think with the backtracking of a lot of the expert forensic testimony that we've seen and the forensic testing that we've seen in the past years shows kind of just how far the FBI let itself go down this unchecked road. And we're starting to only now, I think, really understand the consequences.
And Catherine Miles, you reached out to Darryl Rice's legal team who were part of the Innocence Project. That's where you began to really get access to these court records. Talk about how they felt about Darryl Rice, not just his innocence or guilt, but the kind of person he is.
And this was really noteworthy to me. Once this became the first federal hate crime, and once this became a capital crime, Rice was entitled to what, luckily for him, was really kind of a dream team, defense team. And I, you know, was really, I think, fortunate enough to have the opportunity to work with them in depth. And what they told me again and again and again is, you know, basically that in all of their professional careers, they had never been so certain of a client's innocence as they were in this particular case. And it was really because of their tireless efforts, including their tireless efforts to get access to evidence that should have been made available to them during pretrial discovery hearings. It was only because they kept pushing and they kept thinking, you know, first of all, there's more to this case than meets the eye. And secondly, there's a lot less to the prosecution's case against Darryl Rice than meets the eye. And it was really their research that had been completed that really allowed me to tell the story that I tell in the book.
Yes, that's so true. Now, you and the team explored another possibility. What are you willing to reveal about that other possible suspect to us?
Sure. So what I really wanted to do in the book, in addition to telling the story of Lolly and Julie and, you know, taking a look at these wilderness issues, is also lay out the cases, plural, as objectively as I could, so that readers really felt like they could participate and come to their own conclusion. So I do lay the case out against Darryl Rice as the prosecution had it, including the circumstantial evidence that they had that they believe points to his guilt. But as you say, I also lay out the case against another individual, a known serial killer named Mark Ivanitz, who we know was responsible for at least three of those eight murders that I mentioned earlier. And one of the things that was really interesting to me was that for a very brief moment, he was a strong suspect for the FBI in this particular case, particularly because of some DNA testing they had done of evidence that was found. And then for reasons that the FBI has never been willing to explain to me, they completely dropped their investigation against him, despite the fact that the FBI's own DNA forensic lab was saying you cannot rule out this individual as a suspect. So I go into a lot more detail in the book about why he's such a viable suspect, I think. But again, ultimately, I really want, you know, readers to decide for themselves. This is still an open case, and it's a solvable case. You know, I really kind of believe in the power of crowdsourcing and the ability for, you know, readers or podcast listeners or anyone else to really kind of make a difference in closing some of these cold cases.
So one thing I haven't asked you about is you're very honest in the book about how hard this investigation was on you. In fact, you say that you felt hostage to it, which is quite a strong word. Talk a little bit about that. And also, you know, have you resolved that now?
Yeah, I was very hesitant to adopt this project as a book. I had, at the time, I had just finished a series of articles about a really remarkable woman named Jerry Largay, a 64-year-old retired nurse and grandmother who had gone missing on the Appalachian Trail. And for quite a while, investigators had thought that she had been the victim of a violent crime. It turned out that she had just become tragically lost. So lost that this massive manhunt was not able to turn her up. And so in my reporting on that particular story, I had gotten to become quite close with the family. And in her final days, she had kept this journal that had become a series of love letters to her family when she realized that she was going to basically starve to death. And, you know, the emotional toll that that project had taken on me was really significant. And I was well aware of just the sort of level of emotional exhaustion that had resulted from that. So when my editor and my literary agent were suggesting that this sort of be the next book project, I was still really kind of feeling the effects of that reporting. And I was also really aware of how these types of books have impacted other writers, you know, Michelle McNamara, the author of All Be Gone in the Dark, David Carr, Annette McGivney, were all very vocal about the real cost that this kind of reporting can have. So I went in knowing that this was going to be an all-consuming project that was definitely going to leave a mark. And it was my editor who really encouraged and sometimes cajoled me into including that in the book. The rough draft of the book that I had submitted to her did not include me at all in the book. It was a very sort of, you know, disinterested, arm length attempt at objective reporting. And she very rightly knew that I had to tell my story and my process as part of the book, if I was going to be honest with writers, and also if I really wanted readers to kind of understand the process and the impact. So that became a part of the later draft, and obviously now the published book now. And it was really, really hard, arduous, and sometimes terrifying work that I think I'm still processing in some real ways. But as I say in the book, there was a certain point where what had at one point felt like almost kind of paralyzing fear became a kind of righteous anger. And I think that anger is what really kind of propelled me to finish the book and continues to propel me to do this kind of work going forward.
You say we want justice, and, you know, the women in general who are the victims of violence, that we want justice and it shouldn't be beyond our reach. It is a terrific read, and I think it really works to include your own process in it tremendously. Trailed, One Woman's Quest to Solve the Shenandoah Murders. Catherine Miles, it has been really a pleasure to talk with you about this book.
Thank you. And thank you so much for giving Lolly and Julie's story some attention. I think they more than deserve it.
Catherine Miles is the author of, among other books, Quakeland and Superstorm. Stay tuned for our interview with her about the latter after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and weekly newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. Scientists say that climate change is driving the giant storms that are ever more frequently battering the east and Gulf coasts of the U.S. It's been 10 years since one of the worst of them hit, Superstorm Sandy. It was the deadliest, most destructive, and strongest hurricane of the 2012 Atlantic hurricane season. Catherine Miles wrote the first complete account of what happened during the 9 days of Sandy's life. It's called Superstorm. I spoke with her about the book in 2015. I started out by asking her about the evacuation of NYU Langone Hospital in downtown New York City, a botched operation she covers in the book. Well, Catherine Miles, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for having me.
I went through Hurricane Sandy, not in New York City, but out on Long Island. But I had a close friend who was scheduled for surgery, brain surgery, at NYU Langone Medical Center at the end of October 2012. And as he was awaiting his surgery, Superstorm Sandy hit, and he got evacuated. On page 3 of your book, you describe that evacuation. Tell us what it was that you discovered about the evacuation of NYU and some of the other area hospitals.
Well, this really became an issue both, I think, of policy and infrastructure. And what we saw in Mayor Bloomberg's very late decision to evacuate was a lot of people found themselves kind of ill-prepared, really, to deal with that evacuation order. And that evacuation order did not address folks who were in either assisted living centers or in hospitals. And so those people, by and large, hunkered down. And what we saw with policy and emergency management evacuation policies is that almost everyone assumed, including hospital administrators, that the generators would continue working. And so no matter what happened, there would still be power. There would be emergency backup power. And what we saw was that the surge levels were so high, so fast, that in many of these places, the generators literally drowned. And so what we saw were these darkened floors, darkened stairwells, and while staff had drilled and worked on what they would do in an emergency scenario, it was never really with the idea that it would be in pitch black stairwells, moving patients down 20 flights of stairs, hand over fist with flashlights and things like that. So incredibly dramatic. And I think it really called attention to the fact that a lot of our plans are not sufficient for the disasters of the 21st century.
Yeah, and I want to go back to the issue of Bloomberg and the evacuation. But before we do that, I'd like to ask you more about the storm surge, because as I remember and as you report in your book, Superstorm, you know, Hurricane Sandy was not really a hurricane when it hit New York. It may have been a superstorm. It's really not too clear what exactly it was, but its winds were not at hurricane strength. It was the storm surge that was a problem. Explain that.
Sure, and I think this is a surprise to most Americans, but historically speaking, hurricanes do a lot more damage, particularly in terms of human life, because of storm surge than they do of wind. And if we look at the overall fatalities, we see the overwhelming majority of people who die, they actually drowned rather than being in a house that collapses because of the wind. And what we're learning is that the surge models that we have and the understanding that we have for surge is very site-specific. It's very contingent upon things like tide levels, geography, these sorts of factors. And so a surge, for instance, in the Gulf of Mexico may kind of creep its way up because the tides are not that pronounced, because the terrain on the ocean floor is really quite level. If you apply that same storm to a place like New York or Maine, much higher tides, topography that really funnels water in, what we see is not this gradual creeping of water that most people assume, but instead something that really looks like almost a tidal wave. And that was the experience of so many people, especially on Staten Island and Long Island, that they literally went from being bone dry and thinking everything was fine one minute to these huge waves of water coming in, washing away cars, washing away entire homes. And in fact, the most of the fatalities from the storm were water-related fatalities.
Yes, in fact, we had a case right out here in Montauk. There was a woman who must have felt good enough to be walking her dog out on the road when the storm surge came and took her and the dog away.
And, you know, this is really just sort of an issue of how we deal with risk, both as individuals and as a culture. And what we saw over and over again was people really downplaying the risk that this storm posed. And over 70% of the people ordered to evacuate during the storm disobeyed those evacuation orders. And that's almost an exact inverse of what happened in New Orleans during Katrina, where 70% of the people heeded those evacuation warnings. So it really comes down to our personal responsibility as well as our sort of national ability to communicate risk to people in a way that they're able to internalize it. Social scientists tell us that it takes about 3 days for people to really get that the evacuation order matters, that it's happening to them, that they need to take it seriously. And in the case of Sandy, New Yorkers didn't get that amount of time. They got fewer than 6 hours before public transportation was shut down. So for a lot of people, by the time they decided to leave, they had no way to get out.
And in that case, of course, it wasn't individual responsibility. It was the responsibility of the city of New York, of Bloomberg in particular. Why did Bloomberg downplay the storm until it was too late? That's a very important chapter, I think, of your book, or point of your book, is how that actually happened and why.
I really wanted to try to unpack that for New Yorkers and for the nation, really. And I spent a lot of time talking to people both in the New York City Office of Emergency Management and also senior staff in Bloomberg's administration. And what they told me was that they had assumed that they would be receiving information, surge reports, forecast reports from the National Hurricane Center. But when this storm began to transition into a hybrid, the protocols for the National Hurricane Center were so narrowly defined that they were literally unable to continue issuing watches, warnings, and advisories for the storm. So they made an 11th-hour decision to hand off responsibility for the forecasting to regional National Weather Service offices. And these are offices that are staffed by tremendous meteorologists, very talented, very dedicated people, but they don't have anywhere near the resources that the National Hurricane Center has. And they also don't have nearly the mouthpiece to get that information to a national audience like the National Hurricane Center. So what the folks in New York told me was, look, you know, we assumed we were going to be getting this information from the National Hurricane Center. When that didn't happen, we were getting data that didn't really look familiar to us from the National Weather Service. We were confused. We didn't have what we needed to make a confident decision. The National Weather Service really gets its hackles up when that sort of thing is said, because they say, look, we gave you more than enough information that you needed to make a very decisive decision early. And if we look at, for instance, Governor Christie's response in New Jersey, or if we look at places like Connecticut, Philadelphia, Delaware, who also had evacuation warnings much, much earlier, and using the same sort of information we gave you, we really don't buy that. So we see a lot of back and forth here, a lot of debate. And it's understandable, because obviously this decision put a lot of New Yorkers at risk.
Well, one reason that happened was because an evacuation had been ordered just a year before with Hurricane Irene. And while Hurricane Irene devastated Vermont and other parts north, it gave a pretty light smack to New York City.
That's right. And people talk a lot, especially social scientists, talk a lot about this idea of the Irene effect. And it's sort of a fool me once, shame on me, fool me twice, shame on you sort of situation, where people thought, well, you know, we did evacuate for Irene. We went inland. You know, our homes, meanwhile, were not damaged by floodwaters. We got trapped by the floodwaters inland. We came home, found our homes looted. One of the most tragic stories I recount in the book is that of a family out on Staten Island who, for that reason, decided to stay when Sandy hit to protect their home, because they had been looted and had their home severely damaged by not the hurricane but by robbers. And they tragically were swept away. The father and the daughter died, and the mother, you know, is still kind of trying to put the pieces together for her life.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking about Hurricane Sandy with Catherine Miles. Her book is Superstorm, 9 Days Inside Hurricane Sandy. It's out from Dutton Press. And I want to go back to what you were saying before about the National Hurricane Center passing this on. What exactly was it about this storm that made it so complicated that the National Hurricane Center felt like it was no longer responsible for getting the message out?
And we should say that the meteorologists at the National Hurricane Center felt very responsible in terms of getting the message out. But what we have here is a lot of political bureaucracy that can get in the way of good science. And so the way that the National Hurricane Center was defined by NOAA and by ultimately the Department of Commerce was that the National Hurricane Center forecasts tropical storms and only tropical storms. Sandy, very early in its genesis, began to take on characteristics of a hybrid storm. It merged with a nor'easter and became this sort of classic perfect storm. And when that happened, it was beyond the purview, beyond the sort of narrowly defined mission of the National Hurricane Center. And it created really a disaster of communication for everyone, so much so that in the months after the storm, the entire meteorological community got together and basically said, we cannot let this happen again. And so now the mission of the National Hurricane Center has been rewritten to allow them to continue issuing these advisories, even if a storm does transition. So that's a really good step forward. But it's not enough. And what we have is a just chronically underfunded weather program. We have one surge expert in the entire country who has to, you know, issue these surge forecasts for everyone from Miami to Maine. And that's a Herculean task that would take, you know, 10 people to do really well. And we have this one guy who works tirelessly trying to do it. And that's got to change. We've got to start investing so that we can get the word out, so people can make responsible choices, so we don't see the unnecessary death tolls like we saw in New York and New Jersey.
And is it true, as I think I've heard, that some of the most important weather forecasting machinery or technology that exists has been actually shut down in the United States? We were depending on the Europeans for the early forecasts of Hurricane Sandy.
Well, the National Hurricane Center uses about 40 models to do its hurricane prediction. And it's true that one of them is the European model, and that's one that tends to perform really well. They also use their own models. But what you say about the larger weather infrastructure is entirely true. Because it has been so chronically underfunded for so long, they're really having to piece together with either outmoded equipment. One of the most important devices they use is what's called a scatterometer. It gauges wind speed and wind direction in the atmosphere. Theirs broke years ago, so we rely on other countries for that information. We're relying on the European Union for at least one of our satellite data feeds that we get every day. We are very close to being in a weather satellite gap where America has no functioning weather satellites, and that could continue for over 2 years, in which case we would need to look to Europe or even possibly China for that weather data information. And all of this really came to the forefront because of Sandy. I don't think we really knew just how bad a crisis it was until that storm hit. And so what we have is this real need to invest in infrastructure that's about personal security and also about national security. And I think we need to take that seriously.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Catherine Miles about her terrific book, Superstorm, 9 Days Inside Hurricane Sandy. Now, Superstorm, as you said before, this system collided with a nor'easter. This was an extremely unusual weather pattern. Explain what happened and why do they think it might have happened the way it did?
And what was really interesting about this is the fact that hurricanes and nor'easters are very different types of storms. A hurricane derives its energy from warm ocean water. It sort of sucks up that moisture, and it works almost like a fuel in an engine, really. Nor'easters derive their energy from temperature differentials high up in the atmosphere. So usually when these two types of storms meet, they kind of become a soupy mess, and they cancel each other out. But in the case of Sandy, what happened was they took on sort of the worst characteristics of either storm, and it did become this sort of, you know, Frankenstorm or superstorm. You know, these used to be called the storms of the century because they were so unusual that we thought it could never really happen to us. But what meteorologists are telling us is that climate change, sea level rise, the temperature of the seas also rising, is creating a whole new paradigm for weather and how it works. And we're seeing this everywhere. We're seeing this in storms like Sandy that can get further north than they could ever get before, that are bigger than they ever were before. We saw it in that apocalyptic snowfall late last year in upstate New York. We saw it with the torrential downpours in California and Oregon. Everything we know about weather is changing, and we have to create a system that accommodates these changes to make sure that we're ready for the weather of the 21st century.
Yeah, and that's a point that it seemed you didn't really go into very much in the book, and I wonder why. Of course, it's impossible to tie any one storm to climate change, but as you pointed out, the likelihood of these events is going up, and you know, the national, you know, NOAA has linked increasing numbers of hurricanes and possibly increasing intensity to sea level rise, certainly increasing damage. So I wonder if you could kind of unpack the link and the limits of it and how maybe you've evolved in some of your thinking about that over the course of writing this book.
What really surprised me in my research for this book, and also the reception of the book now that it's out, is just how controversial a subject climate change is among meteorologists. And I've been really surprised by the number of climate change deniers and climate change skeptics who work within the meteorological community that I've come across, you know, through the course of this book. What we do know for certain is two things. As I said earlier, you know, hurricanes derive their energy from warmth. And so the warmer the seas are, the more powerful, the more fuel the storms are going to have, the further north they're going to get. We also know that sea levels are hugely related to surge and the severity of surge. So obviously, the higher the sea level, the higher the surge level. And so, you know, the same storm hitting New York in 1900 is going to have less of an impact than the same storm hitting in 2015 because of these sea level rises. But beyond that, the meteorological community is very reluctant to take a strong stance about the specific ways in which climate change will affect the weather. And I think that's really curious. I think it's something that we're going to really need to focus more attention on and have at least some good predictions going forward so that we can make the accommodations that we need to anticipate those storms.
So do you think it's because weather forecasters are really dealing, I mean, you know, climate change and weather are two different things, as the climatologists keep on telling us. Do you think it's an issue of focus that's really a problem?
I think that may be it. And when we look at how forecasting works, what we're dealing with is past precedent that weighs heavily in a forecast or a model. We're looking at things like, well, what is the likelihood that something is going to happen? So it's really a numbers game. It's a probability game coupled with new technology and things like satellite images. But this idea of this sort of long trajectory and how years or decades could affect the weather, you know, like you say, that is a sort of climatological question, and it's not necessarily within the purview of, you know, the weatherman that we see on the nightly news. So as a community, they haven't really reached a very cohesive voice. I think things like Sandy, I think things like, you know, the Senate finally voting to acknowledge that climate change is real, I think this is going to sort of compel meteorologists to start taking a stronger stance on that, to do more research, to look into the effects. But right now, they're so strapped for funds that we still have so many questions about how hurricanes work, that how hurricanes are affected as climate change is that much more of a complicated question that we just don't have the information to answer.
We're talking with Catherine Miles about her terrific book, Superstorm, 9 Days Inside Hurricane Sandy. And you also bring this story down to the individual lives, especially the story of what happened to one of the tall ships, those, you know, 19th century clipper ship models, the Bounty, which was in the film commissioned by MGM in the 1962 film Mutiny on the Bounty, had on it one of the people that lost their lives was Claudine Christian, who actually claims to be a descendant of Fletcher Christian in the story of the Bounty. Tell us what happened there. That just was heartrending to read.
I really wanted this book to be a very human story. I wanted to tell the narratives and the stories of the people who were impacted by the storm. And the Bounty, as you said, was a really big one. And it was how I first got into this story. When the Bounty left Connecticut, in New London, Connecticut, about 5 days before the storm made landfall. And the captain knew there was weather out there, knew it was a hurricane, but he really felt like he knew hurricanes well enough to guess what the storm was going to do. He felt really confident that the storm was going to take that sort of classic arc out to sea, which is what we see over and over again with these late season storms. And so he thought he would have plenty of room to get around it. And of course, he was tragically misinformed by this. The storm actually ended up in right where the Bounty was. It was sort of a collision, if you will. And so much about this storm defied the rules of hurricanes. So hurricanes have a strong side and a weak side. He made his way to what should have been the weak side of the storm, but that had become inverted. So he inadvertently put the ship in the sort of worst conditions out there. The ship began to take on water. He became very badly injured by some accounts, broke his back. So there's some question about the degree to which he was able to make good decisions, given how much pain he was in. He delayed calling the Coast Guard because he really felt like the ship could make it. In the end, the first mate did call the Coast Guard. Conditions were so dangerous outside that the Coast Guard commander told his rescuers that they couldn't go. They defied him. They went out because they felt like it was so important to try to help. And what came from that was what is one of the costliest, one of the most dangerous Coast Guard rescues in history. Miraculously, they were able to save most of the crew members in a very harrowing rescue. But as you mentioned, Claudine Christian, a new deckhand, a fantastic, really interesting woman, you know, who grew up as a gymnast and a beauty queen and a sorority girl and a cheerleader, and like so many people wanted to find herself on a tall ship, she and the captain of the ship both lost their lives. And, you know, when I started my research, this seemed like such an extreme story for Sandy. But what I learned really quickly is that it isn't. And in fact, it's really emblematic of the decision so many people were making to weather out the storm or to go into the storm, because nobody believed that it could actually be that bad.
And also, the weather's getting more unpredictable, as you say. I mean, it might be a case that global warming had an impact on just the way this storm developed, the chaos of the storm.
And we're seeing weather that we wouldn't expect all over the place. This year we had typhoons well beyond typhoon season. We saw them in places we've never really seen them in modern history, like Hawaii, you know, tornadoes in Washington State. So yeah, you know, new weather. And new weather comes with new risks, bigger risks. And we all have to find a way to acknowledge those risks. One of my favorite quotes from the book is from the commander of the Coast Guard down in North Carolina. And he said, you know, Mother Nature plays to win, and she'll beat you every time. And we've lost sight of that truth. But I think it's time that we really sort of re-embrace it.
That we're not the masters of the universe, we think.
We are not. We are absolutely not. The universe is absolutely the master of us.
That was Catherine Miles talking with Writer's Voice in 2015. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.